You are listening to Radio Albion.
Hello, this is Matthew Raphael Johnson, and on Radio Albion, this is a series, The Orthodox Nationalist, dealing with questions of both the Orthodox Church and its history and theology on the one hand, and the political theory of nationalism, specifically ethno-nationalism, medievalism and anti-modernism, most generally. This is being recorded on the 15th, I think, or the 14th of April, 2024, which means we are, this year, right in the middle of Lent. So I want to keep this in some important areas of theology. The notion of theopolitics or political theology, of course, is essential to everything that I do here. Also, as you know, I'm able to do this because I have donors, some very generous ones, who keep me in business. And in fact, I couldn't function whatsoever for very long at all without my donors and without my friends. I'm way behind on keeping up with people, getting back to them on Patreon and elsewhere. And for that, I am sorry. But I am now so overloaded with things. And, of course, I need your help more than ever. As you know, I don't have a university. I don't have a church. I don't have some faction bankrolling me. No foundation, nothing like that. And without any media backing, I depend on my readers and listeners for financial support. As distasteful as it is to even bring it up, I don't have a choice. So, given that this entire series, it's been going on for quite some time now, is based on the juxtaposition of Orthodox theology, specifically Slavic Orthodox theology on the one hand, and ethnic nationalism on the other, we're going to yet again deal with precisely this theological nexus between those two things. And I've decided today to translate two papers. The first I have, or at least the author, I've mentioned before, Lev Korsavin, murdered by the Soviets in 1952, specifically his paper called About the Dangers of Abstract Christianity. And that was published in, I believe it was 1927, in the emigre journal called The Path. And the other, Nikolai Klepinin, who was murdered in 1941, who, more to the point, wrote in that very same periodical, a year earlier, 1926, his thoughts on the religious meaning of nationalism. So, last night, for the first time in many, many years, I watched Alfred Hitchcock's The Birds. And this came out, I believe it was the first half of the 1960s. And clearly you have the stirrings of the sexual revolution. You have this very attractive woman who's essentially the one of the Kardashians of the era, wealthy family, has no real purpose except chasing men. Chases a man. And they're in Northern California to his house. And, you know, never really married. This guy who she's chasing, one girl after another. Typical Chad of the day, you know. And it's manifest that they have no interest in settling down or anything else. They're just kind of having fun. And when this woman appears, chasing after this man who's a lawyer, she went to Berkeley and, you know, very superficially obvious in that respect. the birds of this fishing village just outside of San Francisco in Northern California turn on the population. Now, of course, birds are always symbols of the soul. Even in the Encyclopedia of Symbolism, it mentions that in all cultures, the bird in general, now there are specific birds who have different purposes, but in general, birds are symbols of the soul. There's a scene in there where one of the townswomen says, this started. These perfectly harmless birds, everything from gulls to crows to sparrows, start attacking people only really when she shows up. Despite the fact that it's statewide, the radio only mentions where they are, Bodega Bay, and San Francisco, that's not, you know, a couple hours away. And there's no accident, of course, that it's San Francisco, because this was beginning already there, and this was very closely associated with the left in general. Now, you'll read all of these terrible superficial analyses of the movie, but it's very clear we're talking about logos. The human soul is distorted, and that distortion is projected onto the natural world. The natural world, as a result of sin, then turns away from its very foundation. It turns away from its instinct and does something completely unnatural. It specifically attacks children. Now, we all can make fun of the really bad special effects and everything else. Saturday Night Live made fun of it. But as we all know, on this program and so many other places, that logos is the core. Without it, the soul deviates from its path. It's no accident that in that movie, there are no father figures, none whatsoever. The woman who then claimed later that Hitchcock had sexually assaulted her in this attempt to be relevant later on in her career. Her father was absent, very much like a Kardashian, but had plenty of money and was pictured doing all kinds. You know, she was a celebrity for really nothing. Part of the Frankfurt School coming out of Berkeley, at least ideologically speaking, that was just getting influential at the time. In fact, I think Marcuse was in California, San Diego, or wherever he was at the time, UCLA, I can't remember. And this man that she's chasing isn't a father. His father died, leaving his mother a widow, and she's terrified of losing him. Without fathers, women go crazy. They become whores, and that's exactly what they're doing here, one after another. In one case, there's a man who actually was at the was sold the feed for the chickens in the area, had his eyes pecked out. Eyes, of course, are the windows to the soul. And it became very clear very early on exactly what this movie was about, and it's going to be more blatant given that this is the early 60s. And this sort of thing has to be implied. There's no realism here. Nothing about it is real. I mean, it's a pseudo-realism. But much had to be implied at the time. But it was very obvious and very clear what was going on. Without the father figure, and hence without logos and nature, without the monarchy, without the head of the family, everything, including these birds, symbols of the human soul, went wild. Remember, the original sin, the Garden of Eden, turned the animal kingdom against us. It's where, you know, meat, which is actually quite good for you, started to be eaten because it wasn't a cooperative. And remember, the sort of food, of course, many, many millennia ago, versus food-like products that we eat now, you know, have nothing in common. You know, fruit is nothing but sugar today, for the most part. But, of course, that wasn't the case centuries or millennia ago. So, and that's very relevant to what we're talking about. In Karsavin's 1927 paper, on the notion of abstract Christianity. And this is in reference to people. We've all met them. They're all over the place. Not just new calendars. People who believe that the church can't be ethnic. Of course, black churches can be, and the synagogue can be, but orthodoxy cannot be. I remember when I visited an OCA parish many years ago in Northern Virginia, I heard the resident intellectual there say, "We have to leave that sort of thing behind," meaning ethnicity. This was in a Serbian church within the OCA, one of the few, actually, that even took the word Serbian off their sign because of the war that was going on at the time and was, unlike today, front page news, which again is not coincidental. But this claim that that's something we need to leave behind. Well, if we need to leave the nation behind, then we need to leave the family behind. And any other super individual, collective or communal entity. And I suppose that the assumption of saying something like that is that the nation is not a natural outgrowth. But what it implies, too, is that only the individual is real, and this individual has to be abstracted, taken out of the communities of which he is born, which, of course, today, they're not born to communities at all. But, you know, we're in such an such a bizarre time that we can actually, you know, it's almost inconceivable, but we abstract the person from the flesh, which would include everything like culture and the state and economics, and all you have is an abstract soul, which, of course, is a figment of people's imagination. They'll believe in stupid things like the international community or European values, or abstract rights that are based on nothing, but notions like the extended family or the nation or the civilization are strictly imaginary. And none of this, of course, is coincidental. It all goes back to special pleading. I've been talking about special pleading now for a while recently, especially when it comes to Israel. Now, the nation is, you know, nations have always existed in the sense that ethnicity has always existed, that which is unified by language, as it's developed over time from the Tower of Babel onward. Language wasn't merely to keep, you know, different languages were not merely to keep evil from spreading, it was also to keep the good, or to allow the good, to flower in many different ways. As I've said many times in the past, remember at Pentecost, it wasn't that the apostles spoke one language and were understood by everybody. No, they spoke, or any of the disciples, everyone around them spoke their own languages. Everyone affected by the descent of the Holy Spirit spoke their own languages, and those diverse languages were understood by everybody. Very different situation. But leftist ideology, yes, it's based on deceit, but partially because it's based on abstraction. Where you take this individuality out of its cultural flesh, matter, which is certainly not evil. This is an old Gnostic idea rejected by the Council of Chalcedon. Chalcedon is essential to this entire project here, because human nature includes all of this that we're talking about, which means that all of this existed prior to creation. It existed in potentia, in a sense, in Christ, in Logos. So Karsavin talks about this terrible misconception of abstract or generic Christianity. And after the Bolshevik Revolution, the Russian diaspora began to be infected by that. Really, the OCA, to some extent, is based on it. We've dealt with the question of Philotism, the robber council, 1871, 1872. We've dealt with that at great length. This became, not of course, you know, before the revolution, but the Greeks under the Patriarchate, without ceasing to be Greek, denied all the other ethnic identities in the Balkans. I mean, there has to be some language, but somehow they think that just like Western civilization sees itself as universal, Greek was seen as this universal language, and that was the only way that the truth would ever be manifest to people. So Christianity is abstract if it's identified with purely theoretical teaching. It's like trying to reduce a theory, an ideology, to just a few lines that you either accept or you reject, removing it all from practical life. Or, on the other hand, with moral and religious activity, taking it from the teaching itself, trying to break the unity of the faith on the one side and worldly affairs from which it's understood on the other. That's what we mean by an abstract faith, because it denies this human nature, claiming that everything has to be divine, everything has to be universal. And that's not how we function. That's not what a human being is. And certainly, to reduce everything to the individual is arbitrary. And it gets worse, because it seems that the conclusion to this is that church things are assigned to this one specific area of life and removed from everything else. This is the denial of Chalcedon, that we can be Orthodox on Sundays, but when we consider things, you know, politically, when we consider economics, we live in a totally different world. It's been shocking over the decades how many people in the true Orthodox Church are in fact normies and everything else, having no idea that the true Orthodox expression implies that the world is ruled by the regime heading towards Antichrist. And one of the ways that he rules is via this abstraction. The church is reduced to a series of propositions that you can accept, but it's lived only within its the categories where it's considered acceptable. Now, Karsavin wants to connect this to the Church of Rome. Remember, the year in which he's writing this, 1926, 1927, or at least that's when it was published, the Church of Rome bore no resemblance to the Church of Rome today. It seems that every day this ridiculous pope, I mean an absolute scumbag, denies his own church and condemns Catholics for being Catholics all over the world. There is no way a Roman Catholic could be anything but a sedevacantist today and remain honest. And it's getting harder and harder for the papalists, people who actually believe that the Pope is this locus of unity, to continue to reinterpret and re-reinterpret everything that this Francis character says. Yes, it's true the regime wants to exaggerate what he says. But associating Catholics with the child molestation, which was, you know, a laughable, there's no more pedophiles there than in any other walk of life. But the point is to remove the Catholic Church in the U.S. as a pro-life force. But you don't have a pro-life pope. So like everything else, it's thrown into utter chaos. So there's two approaches to unity. The first is subordinost, where we have ethnic churches manifesting universal truths in very specific ways. Different places, different topographies, different, you know, situations, different histories, different languages. On the other hand, you have this external unity, and that's the abstract one. The external unity, you know, it's sort of like the New Calendar movement, who condemns people like us, or like me, because we have these terrible the visions. The witness has been destroyed because of it. On the other hand, they seemingly wanting to bow to the Patriarch of Constantinople as some sort of a pope, or something like a papacy, have this external unity with no unity in terms of doctrine or lifestyle. You know, the fate of monasticism and the so-called Antiochians in America is just, you know, one example of this. But in a way, he at the time uses the Roman Church as an example of this abstract universalism because it installs a single liturgy, or did, no more, of course, a single liturgy on almost everyone, the uniates being an exception. Yeah, but the uniates are, as, and I was a uniate many years ago, Catholics of the Eastern Rite, as they're sometimes called. And it's not really a diversity in liturgy, because it was meant to slowly turn into the Latin Rite. Now, of course, there's no rite at all. The point is to gradually bring them, at the time, I'm not talking about 2024, but at the time, 1595 and onward, to bring them into the Polish Empire, and hence the Latin Rite slowly but surely. A long time ago, well, in fact, I have a publication on the Russophiles of Eastern Galicia, which was a hotbed of pro-Russian ideology within the St. George Circle, the Uniate Church, and it, you know, very much mirrored my own struggles in that regard. So things changed in the early 70s, of course. So remember when he's writing in the 1920s, ecumenism with old Rome, you know, the Rome that existed in the 1920s, is a completely different animal than ecumenism with this present pope, this disgusting human being who trades his soul as a Jesuit for media popularity. The Unia at the time was not really an example of this acceptance of unity. When I got interested in the Western Rite many years ago, and the Milan Synod, who, you know, I continue to say positive things about these days, the Autonomous Metropolitan, whatever. When I got when I started learning about the Western Rite, thanks to them, I realized that they had the same liturgical diversity, legitimate ethnic diversity, that you had in the East. Despite the attempts of Constantinople to impose one reformed liturgy in the 19th century. And not only were these very different liturgies from place to place, they were heavily influenced by Greeks and Slavs. And if you go way back, I've published on this, I've written on this, really was a revolutionary, mind-blowing idea here. But that's an exception. You know, so Karsavin, in talking about the Uniates in this regard, asked the question that I asked at the time, and the question that had me leave the Union, which was hard to do. I learned a lot from them. And he's quoting someone who they've canonized, Metropolitan Andrei Shepetsky, the leader, more or less, of the Catholics of the Eastern Rite in Eastern Europe, that, in essence, they turned a blind eye to their people venerating saints that are not accepted by Rome. At Holy Transfiguration, it's a Uniate parish under the Melkites of Antioch in McLean, Virginia. And I went there for a while. I knew the late Father Joe Francovia. And in his office, you know, he passed on a few years ago, he had a large icon of Mark of Ephesus. This is supposed to be a Uniate Catholic parish. You had icons of John of Kronstadt right in the nave of the church. But when Shepetsky was pressed at the time, he had to say, no, you can't pray in front of icons of, say, Russian saints who lived and were canonized after the division of the churches, and were not canonized by Rome. So the very small Russian Catholics of the Eastern Rite had to remove, at Shepetsky's orders, these, Tikhon Ozadonsk and everything else. And yet today, in 2024, I don't think many of them are listening to that. Ultimately, it's to slowly Latinize them. Again, that was the case up until the early 70s. Cultures, languages, and the liturgies that they helped create are in the old Catholic mind outside of the church. That national and cultural life created division and challenged the dominance of the papacy. This is why so many of our people went with the Ghibellines, the royalist party, who accepted this diversity of nations, and hence this diversity of liturgies, many of which are in such obscurity that people don't know they exist. Making matters worse is that you have these Western Rite characters under Antioch who's just doing the Anglican service, the Book of Common Prayer, claiming, not only claiming to be Orthodox, using all of those post-schism developments, but then anathematizing everyone else who actually knows something about the Western Rite. So it's a complete fraud. And that's not even a Roman Catholic thing. That comes directly from the Anglican. Now, Vatican II told a different story. But in no way does this mean that somehow Rome supports the idea of nationalism. In fact, the only nationalism it accepts is Judaic. And that started with Pope John Paul II, who was Pope most of my young life and early adulthood. And so here, Carsalvin puts the concept of religious abstraction at the responsibility of the old Church of Rome. But even today, the Church of Rome promotes ecumenism and liberalism and mass immigration and all this stuff internationally, religiously condemning anyone who rejects it. In other words, Catholics who supported the papacy 100 years ago are now condemned as outside of the church because they don't support Jewish interests. Just whatever's fashionable, whatever the left is promoting, that's what you'll see this papacy officially putting his seal of approval on. But that implies, so you have this universal imposition either way, pre and post Vatican II. So whether it be to the traditional universal rites, Pius V, or the equally universal Novus Ordo, which was meant to replace that, it's still this universal imposition, whether it be liberalism or the old liturgy. But it implies that created things, aspects of human nature, exist not in of themselves, but only as a means to an end, to fulfill this purpose on the other side of earthly existence. There is no salvation within the world, but this devaluation from the transformation or deification of the entire world to something apart from the world. That individual traits and characteristics and the fullness of their existence will be improved and transformed. But if families and nations are to be left behind, then all of these worldly objects will be destroyed. So if only the individual soul exists, that means you will not have a family in heaven. You will not be married in heaven. You will not have an identity in heaven, so to speak. You are still this fully fulfilled but strictly individual being. Rather than claiming that culture will preserve itself, just purged from all sin, in the true fulfillment of its existence. So empirical being is rendered a transitory means. And that would include the nation and culture and language. The church is fulfilled when, ceasing to be abstract, it takes the glorification of the culture and nation, granting them both holiness and immortality. Now, it doesn't mean, of course, that, you know, everyone should be Russian or Greek. That's ridiculous. The whole point of preserving the ancient liturgies, East or West, is to preserve this actual concept of unity in subordinos, which is the very opposite of abstraction. Yes, pagans have to accept orthodoxy. Heretics have to repent of their heresy. But all that implies is that there's many Orthodox churches, and each of them expresses a specific and special cultural and what comes down to a symphonic personality, that taken together, they constitute the full Catholic and Orthodox Church of God. So the coherence of all these constituent local churches, each of which contains the universal whole within themselves, but in their empirical or phenomenal action, have a specific mission, which turns out to be necessary for the completion of the whole. The church is not abstract. It's not a series of doctrines isolated from everything else. It's one of the reasons that the Old Testament is so important to come to learn and to understand, at least for people who have a historical bent. The church does not cut off anything but sin. You know, the old slogan, I've talked about this before, there's neither Greek nor Jew. They don't exist because these two, you know, Jew is, of course, very different now than it was then, exists in their fullness. There's no slavery, no free in it, because slavery exists only in a sinful world. And freedom is a human word, too weak and imperfect, as Korsavin would say. It doesn't express the fullness of church life, because they're free people only in contradistinction to slaves. And we all know how that's certainly not abstract either. Freedom as a juridical question is meaningless. Most people today live as slaves. Both ideologically, they accept whatever they're told, and they're usually paying off debt in the interest of debt, both publicly and individually. So calling them free is ridiculous. Now, formally, they might be. Legally, they might be. But that doesn't mean anything today. And that's racial, and, you know, white males are third-class citizens. So this also is this abstract universalism, which liberalism and Marxism, all forms of leftist ideology, is based upon. And yet Orthodox people, according to Korsavin, still haven't fully understood the problem. There is no such thing as a generic Orthodox person. There's no such thing as Orthodox Christianity. It's Orthodox Catholicism. Greek and Roman Catholic were, you know, the two sides of the divide. But in exile, it was the case in many places where the Russian nation became separate from the church. In certain places more than others. Despite the fact that even liberals in exile did cling to so many of the Russian traditions, it does, however, stand out how many, including Orthodox clerics, very easily accepted the fall of the autocracy, fall of the monarchy, thinking that the separation from the church from the state is a great thing, because it freed the hierarchy from the old Petrian Synod. And that's an excuse we've dealt with on this show before. But from an ecclesial point of view, that has no bearing on anything. The so-called freedom of the church from the state, this abstraction, is not the freedom from the oppression of emperors and over-procurators. No one thought about duty or responsibilities, but the rights that were clarified by the Bolsheviks later on, and the reaction in the higher monarchist council abroad. Now, Korsavin, writing when he did, makes some errors in his work. the church. And, you know, because again, 1927, Stalin hadn't taken over yet. And, you know, eventually they're going to kill this guy, and he will learn, unfortunately, the hard way. But his point of view was the church education enlightens our conscience so that freedom can be used in the proper way. The church embraces concrete being. This is part of what Chalcedon is. Human nature isn't some abstraction. It's everything that makes a man. It's all of the cultural manifestations, everything from art to literature, in their specificity. The only thing that gets cut off are things that are distorted and perverted or inverted. When St. Augustine was sent to Britain, St. Augustine of Canterbury, I mean, there was no concept of anything called paganism. That's not a theology. It's not a religion. I've dealt with this in the past, too. But it just referred to customs that existed outside of the church. And Gregory the Great made it clear there's nothing wrong with any of those unless they blatantly deny natural law or church doctrine, which are essentially, you know, one and the same thing. The nature of evil, which does not have an independent existence, is a distortion always of something that's good. The key element to keep in mind is that abstract Christianity, seems to divide the world into that which the Christian life can affect and that which it does not affect. Certain things are Christianized, certain things are not. And this is made worse, of course, in modernity and postmodernity. Many of us who converted as adults confronted a life that had absolutely nothing to do with Orthodoxy, putting us at a terrible disadvantage compared with our brethren, you know, centuries ago. But to be saved, quote unquote, to use a Protestant term, to be brought into the church is not to leave your worldly qualities. You don't throw it off. You don't put on something new, this abstract church-based identity based around canons. This transformation that he is seeking in an erroneous form is not in relation to the fullness of the empirical existence or phenomenal existence, including that of the nation and the extended family. But it's only applied to the soul, which is equally abstract. It's applied to something artificially abstracted from reality. That which is outside of the church is not necessarily evil. It's just, well, for practical purposes, we have to accept it. And we certainly not only cannot do that, but we're obligated to fight it with every way we possibly can. But that kind of approach, that abstract Christianity, is inherently dualistic. You see it with the Protestants. That'll go so far as to claim that, you know, the state in the West can decide whether a marriage is legitimate or not. That the Constitution is almost a semi-inspired document. And of course, we all know the only thing they really care about is the Jews are the manifestation of divinity on earth. There, of course, even the persecution of Christianity in the Holy Land is acceptable from their point of view. And the doctrines of the church don't apply. The doctrines that they espouse only really apply to their day-to-day life, whatever's easy to apply it to. The dualism is based just on that, that there's areas that the church may apply to, doctrine may apply to, and that's always changing, and areas that, for whatever reason, however they rationalize it, it does not apply to it. Nominalism, I don't have to tell you, is at the root of all of this, and nominalism and Lutheranism developed and were accepted at the same time. That's when Christ says that my kingdom is not of this world, has nothing to do with rejecting anything in the phenomenal world. No, it's the full manifestation of the world in the proper sense, not in the sense of power or the seeking after riches or anything else. a dualism that comes from this point of view, makes the distinction between, you know, there is no, in Protestantism, there is no Christian culture. So that's a void to be taken over by the state and now, of course, by corporate America. When you reduce Logos to literally a book, I don't know if you've ever seen that product. It's so grotesque. You have intelligent people who, in dealing with, you know, the beginning of John's gospel, actually have a picture of the Bible as if that's what Logos, word made flesh, means. Actual words, meaning words and letters. That's what they actually think Logos is. That it has to do with a book, and the book itself, then, by their mentality, has to predate Christ's coming. So that's the dualism that's created. That earthly life, phenomenal life, this seems to be a place where a person is sent for some temporary exercise. It doesn't really have value one way or the other. You know, he could earn money on earth. He could do things to earn himself the kingdom of heaven, in the Calvinist sense of the term. And that's the only thing that the world was created for, and it will disappear, and everything in the world will disappear. And we'll just go in the heavens as abstract harp-playing creatures on clouds and all the rest of it. One of the results of this is what I've condemned before in the work of Father John Romanidis, who denies the very existence of the connection between created truths, which are just utilitarian and practical empirical truths, and the uncreated. They're not the same thing, to quote him directly, that created truths are one thing and the uncreated are entirely different, and that there's no likeness between them. Created truth, you know, he, of course, Romanidis, being the new calendar theologian, you know, accepted modern science as a created truth. And he accepted, as most of his people do, accept these things as a matter of course, evolution, which has nothing to do with empirical science. But Holy Scriptures, to them, they're not the source of knowledge, created or otherwise. It's an uncreated truth. It only matters because those who have experienced the uncreated glory of God have written it, which means that the experience of grace doesn't have any external referent. There's no rational way to tell the difference between someone who's rhapsodizing because of legitimate grace and holiness versus prelest or some demonic, you know, the Russian word prelest really also means charm. There's no way to tell the difference since there is no distinction between, or there is no connection between created truth and uncreated truth. Now, what does this have to do with the nation? Let's switch over then to Kleppinen's thoughts on the religious meaning of nationalism. And it's a very similar argument. And the question is ethno-nationalism, that is the treatment of the ethnic group very much like the family, as natural and as real, and therefore worthy of preservation, that this is a good part of the hierarchy of good things, the hierarchy of values. Now, nations are understood subjectively often in times of severe pain and dislocation. People came to understand the Russian ethnicity primarily through the exile. And therefore, the nation is connected with the church. So we're talking about just the theology of the nation. And a healthy mentality sees national work as religious work, and vice versa. To remove the religious conception of nationalism is to imply and attempt to live this abstract and generic Christianity. Nation is one of these values, like the family, like our individuality, that exists in a hierarchy of universality. that the departure from nationalism is, in fact, an aspect of a religious crisis. And ethnicity, we're not talking about symbolic expressions of ethnicity. I'm talking about actually living it, as I did when I was in grad school amongst the Ukrainians. And I was a Union at the time. So either today people are terrified of it, they don't fully understand it, they think it may have something to do with, you know, supremacy, and, you know, the only people who actually argue that are Jews. Or at least they're indifferent to it, because it's one of those things that doctrine does not touch in their world. And they kind of forget about it. To them, nationalism is some sort of an obstacle. They make an arbitrary distinction between nationalism and patriotism, which doesn't exist anywhere. It's you know, it's an arbitrary distinction. Nationalism is the treatment and the understanding that social life comes directly and is totally the responsibility of the nation, because that's where language manifests itself. It defines, and not just words and syntax and meanings, but all forms of communication. I mean, most communication isn't verbal. All of that is included in language. But it came under attack, well, at least according to Klepinin, in the 1860s. And it developed at the same time atheism did. The nihilist in Russia was, maybe in Turgenev's book and elsewhere, was not someone who believed in nothing, but someone who believed in the empirical truths of science. They were positivists. But empirical truths, created truths, they're not logical truths. They're not certain. They could change tomorrow. People accept them because the powerful accept them. And they don't want to be called a conspiracy theorist or a lunatic and lose their job and God knows what else. So they go along with it and don't really think about it very much. And of course, not everyone can think of it. But this is one of the results of this kind of abstraction. Because a positivist, there is no context. In fact, they reject the very concept of context. Now, of course, they have no choice but to, because they also come from a context. They don't want to talk about it, but they do. Their story is largely mythical, where they came from, etc. But whether it be the physics, the mechanics of Newton, whether it be the economics of Smith, Malthus, and Darwin. Darwin came directly out of Malthus. Or any other approach to a positivist concept of science, there is no context. The only thing that exists, the only thing existing are purely quantitative values, things that can be operationalized or turned into numbers. And that's the ultimate result of this abstract life. But living this aimless life of abstraction, even if you universalize the material world as all materialists have to do, they'll still defend this blind, aimless life, and they'll jealously reject any recognition. And you see how angry they get at any religious or absolute meaning. That for them, there's only one absolute phenomenon. And even that can't be absolutized for long. They can't absolutize freedom because there can be no free will in that mentality. So they come up, as we spoke of before, many rationalizations and justifications for it. But we're talking about then the ultimate context, which for us is the Orthodox nation, or even the nation as such. The love for one's people. And in many cases, the state that this people has created, including a monarchy. And this range of values that are created by suffering generations of people that we come to feel as our own, just like our family. We feel not as something separate from reason, but completing reason. This isn't a passive love that we can observe from the outside, but it requires labor. It requires creative effort. And in certain extreme cases, sacrifice. Nationalism includes the whole range, the gamut of values that are absolutely essential for any earthly rationality, because everything, every theory, every idea has to be manifest at a specific time and place, and hence a social context and language. But it's not merely an acceptance of the nation as one of these, you know, part of the hierarchy of values, but it's also the refusal to give the nation a religious meaning. And somehow it's associated with sin. So in their attacks on nationalism, they redefine it, and it refers to some sort of military or militarist aggression, despite the fact that militarism tends to be that of empires, not of nations. You know, World War I was the result of imperialism, which is the very opposite of nationalism, especially since it was started by the Austrian Empire against a fervently nationalist Serbian, a new, although suffering, Serbian state. So they try to reduce the objective reality of nationalism to some sort of vice. But it also emanates from this sense of abstraction, and they connect this abstraction with the purity of religion, that nothing that they claim comes from the world could pollute their immaculate vision of the faith with its inferiority. And of course, we live under a regime that wants to paint almost all nationalists as irrational. And it's true that this non-Christian nationalism of the Protestants, you know, their typical dehumanizing, you know, redneck conception of nationalism, I mean, there's some truth to it, that this should, it's something that should be rejected because it comes from complete and total alienation in the lies of Protestantism. But at the most serious level, the nation is a part of human nature. It's natural in that sense, just like the family is. If the extended family is a part of human nature, then the nation, which protects and ensconces the extended family, has to also be natural. The national has to be natural. So the denial of nationalism is the denial of Chalcedon, because it rejects the notion of human nature. No one can deny that peoples naturally create nations, because they have to communicate. You know, they can't start getting things done and then form nations. They have to occur all at the same time. So a religious justification for ethno-nationalism is a justification for all legitimate, natural human value. The human created aspect of the world. So it has to be from Chalcedon that we come to recognize and then justify rationalism. Nationalism as human and therefore eternally manifest by Christ at the right hand of the Father, because it is human, and human nature, including the flesh, not the perverted use of it, because of course anything good can be perverted. That's the very definition of evil. But this is something that's been saved, that's been deified already, and at the end of time will be deified once Antichrist, you know, Adam Kadmon, is overthrown. But both the New Testament and the Church Fathers, their writing is based on the fundamental difference between the absolute value of divinity and its coming salvation and deification of everything earthly. Now, under certain circumstances, you know, earthly things can be belittled and degraded as a way to highlight the fullness of divinity. You see some of this in the Old Testament. That doesn't mean that that's an absolute principle. It's a matter of strategy. But, you know, the ascetic in 2024 feels the same vanity of life just as any monarch of ancient Israel. The futility of earthly things is a matter of virtue and vice, not of the earthly thing itself. You could turn nationalism into evil. You could use it to denigrate others, but it would be a false use of it. You know, again, assuming that the denigration doesn't come from any good reason. You're not enemies. You haven't, you know, been attacked by them, whatever. But to think, you know, the heavenly and divine will glorify all things that are human. The only thing that's relative is our attitude towards human things. Now, connecting these two things together, you essentially have three different answers to the connection of the divine and the human natures. And the first is that there is an impassable gap, as Roman Didis and his followers will say, between God and the world, between spirit and the flesh. The refusal to believe that the absolute, the eternal, can, without deterioration, be present in the poor, sinful flesh of the world. That coexistence is impossible because it would be a denigration to the divine principle. There are two different areas of existence that cannot and do not touch one another. And that's why the concept of abstraction and Brother John and all of this is essential in understanding it. And therefore, the material world is accepted either as absolute itself, which can't be maintained for long, or it's illusory. It's a psychological worldview. Because people lack faith, they could tear everything significant away from life and transfer it to an area created by the mind. You know, it's easy to consider God as part of this transcendental realm, having no connection with the phenomenal. But that's exactly the point of the incarnation. This worldview ultimately comes down to monophysitism, advocates the purity of faith at the expense of everything else. The second answer connects the divine and human is some deviation towards pantheism. Pantheism is an overused term. It gets extremely complicated. And it sees that there's this depth hidden in the flesh, in the phenomenon of the world, which in fact ends up being illusory. And you have these cults that see it as deified just in and of itself. And sin isn't possible if you're already, in fact, deified. And there is a subconscious and psychological pantheism, as Kalpinen talks about. And that any religious service to earthly values and an affirmation of their self-sufficient significance, that's a deviation into pantheism. But nothing is self-sufficient, what we're talking about here. And the third, of course, is Chalcedon. That there is a fundamental difference between the divine and the created, that the divine essence, the one unity of the Holy Trinity, is so different from everything created that it's mutually inaccessible. Every name and definition we apply to God can't even approximately describe who he is. Everything exists only insofar as it participates in God as Logos. That's a very different story. And that's the solution to the problem. Logos is the solution. Inanimate things participate in God by their very being, animals through their instinct, and man both by reason and free will, as St. Dionysius would say. The flesh, the world, everything human can lie in sin, but that has to do with how it's used, not its ontological status. Sin is a perversion. It's a corruption. It's negation or the void somehow grafted onto being. But Christ himself said, "Be of good cheer, I have overcome the world." It's been substantially overcome by Christ, and the redemption has been accomplished. But in the history of the world, sin is still grafted onto everything that exists and has to thus be eliminated. So until the day of harvest, as you read in the New Testament, the tares are going to grow in the same field as the wheat. So everything existing is created by God, is sanctified without no longer being a creature. Of course, it's always going to be a creature and part of creation. It's external in its relation to the essence of the Creator, is alive and truly exists and is fulfilled only by union with the divine. The Logos, of course, has always existed in nature, but it was never manifest with such clarity as the incarnation. Of course, the corruption of sin is mingled with every creature, but creation participates in Logos, not, of course, by sin, but in its essence. And no matter how strong a sin that distorts this essence, existence and life itself is a victory over sin. Sin is Satan's constant desire to invert what God has created. It's based on his own viciousness. Satan's job is to break the connection of creation with the Creator, to have human beings start thinking, as you know, the Titans in Greek mythology did, that their selfhood is an absolute, and their will as an individual is absolute. And that's the ultimate crime. That's what it is to be a murderer from the beginning, as Christ says in John. So you have two poles of existence, the divine and the created, united inextricably and inseparably in Christ as a man. The human nature of Christ was born immaculately, the true essence of humanity, but of course devoid of sin. Its created essence in its pure form, without any corruption. And this, after the ascension, is today reunited with God in heaven. The human, the divine and human are united in all phenomena of the world too, just not hypostatically, but through grace. So in assessing any phenomenon, anything in our empirical world, you have to distinguish between the essence created by God, which is the very reason for its existence, the spark of life in it, and that which is distorted by sin, that where the void has come in and manifests and will always manifest itself in a world that lies in this evil. But evil is manifest in how we approach something. It's a human problem. So you have this dual attitude of Christianity to the world, which occasionally is seen as a contradiction. So we could affirm and praise God's creation. On the other hand, we could reject and condemn it. That has nothing to do with the essence of things. The condemnation is aimed at its perversion and inversion. To pervert is to turn away. Of course, to invert is to render something completely upside down. So rather than the material being subordinate to the spiritual, the opposite is true, and ultimately the spiritual extinguished in human life altogether. And the nation is no different than any other natural essence. And it's an aspect of reason itself. We've talked about that with George William Frederick Hegel and the Slavophile. The sacrifice, the virtues, have to come from the ethnic unity because it's based on our mutual communication. This is where our love comes from. Gold has to be purified from the dirt around it, not discarded. The gold will be melted down in the fire of suffering, and that way will be purified without ceasing to be matter. That's the transformation, the essence of everything. And the end and purpose of everything will appear at the end in its true and purest form. Everything that we love on earth will be glorified, and the new heavens and the new earth come into existence. The nominalists can't make sense out of any of that, and they have this very bizarre perception of just their individual soul with some conception of their body floating around without any connection to anything else like they had on earth. No, if it's a natural object in the phenomenal realm, it's a natural object and therefore part of human nature in the noumenal realm or the spiritual realm. But this purification, using the gold metaphor, comes from the suffering that the void will always force us through. And these two writers, Kalpinen and Krasavin, knew it firsthand. Not only as exiles, but then eventually captured and murdered by the Soviet authority. An authority that had as one of its symbols the scythe of Saturn, which is meant to separate the divine and the human. It's a scythe that cuts down the connection of created and uncreated truth, then absolutizing their material point of view. Capitalism, of course, does the same thing. And then asserting that freedom and happiness is connected to production and science and nothing else, because there is nothing else. St. Basil, and I'm going to quote him, I'm quoting him directly from the Russian here, and this is where we're going to end. St. Basil says, "We do not at all honor or call good that which brings us perfection in this life alone, but we extend our hopes further and do everything to prepare ourselves for another life. Therefore, whatever helps us towards it, we say that we should love it and strive for it with all of our might, and what does not pass into it, we should despise as worthless." So there are only certain moments of genuine life, moments of prayer and turning to God, where we see our own purpose as a human entity. But this is a collective matter. This is a communal matter, never as an individual one. Because nothing we have comes from us. It comes from the collective, including the Trinity. Labor on earth can be labor and creativity in God if it develops this eternal element inherent in every essence, in everything earthly, if it's directed to the God-created essence of things and the ultimate purpose of things and not to their sinful perversity. The nation, because of the universal aspects of language and how we are communal beings, is a part of the natural order and hence part of natural law. Its essence and its positive principle is blessed by the church. It's the individuality of an entire people and a creative love and support for this individuality. And it is blessed as the great completion of the world lies in the diversity of these units. It has to be, however, developed, like the parable of the talent, and turned to the service of God. Otherwise, it's mere vanity. And St. Basil says that in many places. And he is talking about the gospel parable of the talents. We're not talking about individualism. The individual is a collective entity. We're not talking about self-isolation and this utilitarian self-interest. It's conciliar. It goes to subordinus. It's the Christian understanding individuals as members of inherently members of a body, manifest in the nation. But without a connection to this, the individual dies and becomes purposeless physically as well as intellectually. Christianity has to reject the nominalist, this colorless void of globalization. Individual characteristics, this proud isolation of the individual, are completely erased into nothing. There is a legitimate conception of diversity in the world, and that's to be found in nations and their specific role within the church. And there'd be as many nations and languages and hence liturgies as there are groups of people on the planet. And it's in suffering where we purify and work for this group. It becomes, as the Bible would say, a living stone, the multitude of which the living building of the church and our life is composed. Again, let me quote St. Basil, part of his rule. He says, "Since the gifts of the Spirit are different, and since one cannot accept all of them, then everyone must remain chastening in the gift given to him, and everyone must agree with each other in the love of Christ, like the members in the body. Therefore, the one who is inferior in a gift in comparison with one superior to him should not despair, and the superior should not despise the lesser. For those who are divided amongst themselves and rebel against each other are worthy of destruction." And that's St. Basil's argument and his conclusion for how natural the community is. It's a national individuality. It's a gift to an entire people, binding it together, binding it into a single whole despite individual differences. Just as for the individual, the correct Christian path is in the development of one's gifts, the same thing goes for a people, the development of a common nationwide one. The entire people is more complex in the phenomenal world than the individual, of course. So the gift would be more complex, and then serving it requires more sacrifice. But the essence of this service is entirely justified, true nationalism never contradicts universality. The path to the universal and universal truth is manifest in the national. Precisely because we are human and hence we are intellect and flesh, not just intellect. Hence, rejection of the nation is the rejection of Chalcedon. Thank you, everyone, for listening, and I'll talk to you next week. Bye-bye.